Pays to be Vaccinated contest, your COVID-19 vaccination could pay off big time. Every Friday in August, you could win $150,000 and two scholarships of $10,000. Plus, if you've had both shots September 3rd, there's a draw for 16 scholarships of $20,000 and a jackpot of $1 million. Register now for the It Pays to be Vaccinated contest at quebec.ca/vaccination contest. The sooner you're vaccinated, the faster you can take part. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
From Turtle Island to Palestine, occupation is a crime. Free, free Palestine! You're listening to Radio Free Palestine.
Welcome everyone, you are listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CQUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Stay tuned.
Looking for that document, you know it exists, it disappeared. Take us step by step to the moment that you found that document.
It was in the earlier stages of existence. We were really just trying to figure out what is already publicly available in various archives.
The routine of working in archives are quite boring. You order a file and you don't know what kind of document you will find. Can take you 2 minutes if it's a two-pager, or it can take you a day if it's 500 pages.
And it was in this capacity that we stumbled upon this document, a document that was composed in March, I think, of 1948 by an intelligence officer for the Haganah/IDF, which was forming it these days, in which that intelligence officer lists both the depopulated Palestinian villages and towns, but also lists the reasons for the depopulation. And I think, unlike the history that we grew up on, as Jewish Israelis here in Israel, that intelligence memo, nicknamed the immigration document, tells a very different story. It says, among other things, that some 70% of Palestinian depopulation in Palestine up to that point in early March of 1948 was due to activities by Jewish forces rather than what we learned, result of Palestinian leadership calls for people to evacuate or other civil reasons.
Sometimes you have like this small moment, then you know when you are in the archives, you find a document that, you know, okay, this is a good document. This is a document that can tell a story. I think the interesting story about the immigration report, it's not only the contents of this 18 pages, but it's the story about what the state tried to do with this document.
Welcome to the 972 podcast. I'm Henry Ashakar, and every episode we explore issues and stories that other media outlets tend to ignore. I'm here with Lior Yavne and Adam Raz from Akevot. Hi.
Hi.
Hello.
Lior, can you explain what Akevot is?
HaKavod is a research institute that really works at the nexus of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, human rights and archives. It started off nearly 7 years ago when myself with a small group of human rights professionals working primarily on issues of human rights in the occupied territories figured suddenly that a lot of what we in the human rights community are trying to prove through Palestinian eyewitness testimonies, through soldiers' testimonies, etc., can actually be found in official government documentation. And the archives are actually, we realized, was an arena that the human rights movement did not bother with. So we thought we invented the wheel, and then I went home and Googled it a little bit, and as it turns out, we did not really, because apparently in quite a few locations around the world, civil society organizations and human rights organizations have been working in and with archives to further their work, very often in post-conflict scenarios, like in Latin America and the Balkans and South Africa and Northern Ireland to an extent. So there have been groups doing work that similar to what we thought we should be engaging in. And there was a lot of organizations to learn from at the time. So after about a year or so of trying to develop how to make this thing happen based on the experience of others and based on needs analysis in our local context, HaKavod started operating in November of 2014. We have four programmatic areas. One of them is, and really the foundation for everything that we do, is our digital archive, which currently houses some 300,000 documents, as a rough estimate, on various aspects of the conflict, in its most widest sort of meaning. And we use this to serve all our work. So the second program area, and one that Adam is heading, is conducting research based on this archival documentation, and at the same time trying to tell primarily Jewish Israeli audiences a more accurate, perhaps a more fact-based history of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict than the one that we grew up on and the official story. On another program, which goes directly to our original idea of funding HaKavod, we regularly support human rights organizations and other human rights defenders, various communities, etc., with archival documentation that can serve their needs today. It can serve their litigation needs, their research, their advocacy. And we've been working over the past few years with most, I think, organizations based in Israel on these matters. And lastly is an area of work we didn't really think of at the beginning, but soon realized we need to engage in, is overcoming unlawful barriers to public access in government archives. We've learned early on that while the Israeli law related to public access to the government archives is actually fairly liberal, it's fairly good, the practice is very different. Which brings us to a situation in which the vast majority of Israeli government archives are actually closed to the public. If we talk of what appears to be the largest government archive in Israel, the IDF and Security Mechanism Archive in Tel HaShomer, this houses some 12 million files, of which only 50,000 have actually been opened for the public. That's roughly 0.5%. If we disregard the personnel files, again, we don't go over much of 1%, a single percent of the holdings of this archive that are open to the public. This, obviously, has an immense impact on how Israeli society understand its recent past, how we are able to talk about what happened here, the reasons behind it, and how things actually happened. So now, without a functioning archives that allow proper access, we are confined, or our history is confined, to press reports and individual interviews and whatever documents former officials took home with them and decided to allow researchers access to. So this is, I think, one of our most important struggles from our beginning until today, make sure the Israeli government archives actually work in line with what the law dictates.
Let's dive deeper into one theme that I'm picking up on in your response, the idea of offering a fact-based, accurate understanding of the history of this place, the history of Israeli rule. Given this context that you're describing, why does Arkivot need to exist?
I think without the archives, the struggle for human rights in context of the Israel-Palestine conflict is missing a lot. We are able to show, well, let me put it this way. I think the value given to archival documents written by government officials for the purpose of their public work is one that can hardly be disputed even by opponents of the human rights movement, of the human rights organizations. I will also say that I'm not aware of a lot of human rights research in Israel that is based on the archives. There is a lot of research on things that are happening on the ground, and the various Israeli human rights organizations are doing amazing work in monitoring the situation on the ground and in working vis-a-vis the state responding to this. What I think the movement is lacking is this, I won't say historical perspective, I think it's really a political perspective, some understanding into the inner workings of the state, of the government, of the military. And these documents often provide us some deeper understanding of the reasons, of the policies we are fighting against for today. There is very little that is new in terms of human rights violations in the OPT, certainly within Israel proper. I think we've seen in one of our earlier projects, looking at the first year of the occupation, that much of the phenomena we are struggling against today, house demolitions, et cetera, has their roots in these earlier days of the occupation. And we can find transcripts of conversations and internal correspondence in which people, high-level officials or mid-level officials, speak openly of their motivations or of their ideas of how things should be done. These provide, I think, an important insight for us.
Archives is the collective memory of the state and the society, okay? And if the archives are closed, well, you can't tell the true story of what the state did, okay? And in our situation of conflict and of occupation, the current situation that the archives are closed are given the to the Israeli state, the Israeli politician, they give them the power to tell only their side of the story. Okay, so
what do you mean by that, only their side of the story?
Because if you want to tell the truth about the conflict, you need and you need documentation. When I'm saying story, what is the story? If you want to tell the story, you need fact. And in modern society or when you have a state, okay, the facts are you can find them only in documents. Okay, this is the strongest thing we have if you want to tell a story,
as opposed to the version that politicians might give.
Yes, okay, no, even the documents are a version, but the apparatus or the apparatus that control the releasing of document are actually controlling the way that the society as a whole understand herself, her history, the relation between the society and the state, and of course the foreign policy of the state. So there is a line between our effort to tell the story of 48 or the story of 67 or...
This, you mean 48 is inside Israel proper, 67 is the occupied territories?
Yes, yes. We are not only trying to tell the story, but we're trying to tell the story based on documentation. And when we are trying to tell a true story, we have found out that most of the documents are closed. So there is a relation, an intimate relation between the our struggle to open a document and access to archives and our effort to tell a story for the Israeli Jewish about our society.
You mentioned that your main audience are Jewish Israelis. What kind of impact does concealing archives, concealing historical documentation have on the understanding that the population here has of what's going on around them, whether it's their own history or whether it's current political developments?
I mentioned earlier that we've learned that in various places around the world, organizations doing, civil society organizations doing archival research showed up in post-conflict scenarios. And while the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is obviously very much alive, I don't think it can be disputed that the situation within Israel proper, the relationship between the state and the Palestinian citizens of Israel, is a very much unaddressed post-conflict situation. The state of Palestinian citizens of Israel is to a great extent a direct result of 1948. And unlike perhaps many other areas, here the state does not try to open up a discussion of the event and its aftermath. On the contrary, we see recent legislation not allowing to commemorate the Nakba in publicly funded schools or publicly funded institutions. We see an attack from certain sectors of Israeli society on people who are discussing the Nakba. And we see an attempt to attack this, what people often call here the Palestinian narrative, based on very little. Comes to mind a recent booklet published, what was it, 3 or 4 years ago by some right-wing actors under the title Nakba Harta, right? Nakba Bullshit, in rough translation. But this is because the Nakba is, on the one hand, still very much existing in sort of in public consciousness, on the one hand, and on the other hand, very much being, the memory of it is and its legacy is being very much suppressed. And I think our role in this, not alone, other organizations, Israeli and Palestinians are involved in various other ways. But I think for Akevot, our role is to highlight not only the Nakba and what happened there, but to a great extent also the legacy of it and the mechanisms that the state has used later on in controlling Palestinian population within Israel. And from this comes our project on the military rule that has been going on for some time now, an era that for most, certainly Jewish Israelis, has been made forgotten.
You're talking about the military rule from 1948 to 1966?
Right, the military rule through which the state, through a military permit, regime control, controlled some 85% of Palestinian citizens of Israel at the time.
They put them in ghettos. They gathered all the Palestinians who didn't flee or weren't expelled during 1948 and put them in ghettos and put them under military regime, basically.
Well, partly. Ghettos, as some Israeli officials referred to them in documents that we were able to find, existed in several towns in 1948, 1949, and later slowly dissolved, I think. But as soon as 1948, late 1948, we see the creation of the military rule, which was in place on various stretches of land, particularly on Palestinian villages. And Adam has been researching this era for quite a bit, and one of the results of this research is this book that we recently published, supported by a crowdfunding campaign, that provides some 100 documents on and about and off the military rule in an effort to allow people here better access to these primary sources on the military rule, because for the most part, people don't go to archives to learn their history.
And it's a new way, an interesting way to tell a story, okay? Not only with regular or normal books, but it's an album, and then you can browse through the document, and like you don't need that the editor will interpret the document, but you can read the document and understand it if there was a ghetto and what this sort of ghetto and so on.
I'll say that this is a bit of a deviation from our normal way of telling stories. We work normally with digital tools. Adam, being a very traditional historian, is very keen on books, so we allowed him to go his way.
You got a pass on this one. So the book, when you say documents, it includes internal correspondence, it includes meeting minutes, maps, testimonies. How did you curate these documents? How did you decide what goes in, what you want people to interact with directly?
Wow. Well, first of all, we work in the last few years to collect documents from various archives. So we have documents from 6, 7, 8, I don't remember, archives in Israel, okay? So we decided what is the story that we are trying to tell about the military rule. And after some time, we understand that we want to tell the story as a whole from different perspective of the military rule, okay? First of all, this is a story about the mechanisms of the military rule. It's not in history from below. This is the story of the state, okay? This is the story of the operation of the military rule.
I feel that this was a conscious decision we made early on. There is a variety of documents written by Palestinians and available, but in this book, we thought that the story that we now need to tell is the story of the mechanism, not so much its impact on the ground, although there are some documents dealing with that as well in the book, but about the various tools that the mechanism used, the reasons behind it, and what the state told itself.
Yeah, and from my point of view, as a Jewish, as an Israeli, I think it's a good way, or it's an efficient way to tell the story for the Israeli reader, Israeli audience. Because when you read in this document about the way that the military rule control the economy of the Palestinian Israel, or how they control the land. So when you read the document from the Israeli perspective of the Israeli authority, I think it's much more stronger than to read a letter of Palestinian who live in Israel who write about this as a complaint to somebody. So I think this is we choose the way how to tell the story, and there is we divided it into chapter about policy, about the permit regime, about controlling the political sphere, and so on. And we choose the document, the best document that we have, and we with the document we tell the story.
But this question of perspective is important, obviously, and I think everybody who's been working on in any archive soon realizes that people, we tend to sort of adopt the point of view of the authors of the archival documentation very easily. This is a hazard that any researcher should try to avoid. Adam mentioned that we focus mainly on the work of the mechanism, which obviously counts through Israeli perspectives. In other efforts that we have to tell the story of the conflict, we make sure to incorporate the Palestinian perspective as well, wherever possible. We're just about to launch a podcast series of our own. Sorry, Ingrid. A narrative podcast series telling the stories of several either unknown or unknown events or events that were not properly researched, and obviously we focus again on state documentation, but also ensure that we incorporate the Palestinian perspective, the receiving end perspective on the stories. Perspectives are major, obviously, in any narrative, and certainly in one that is it's contested as the Israel-Palestinian conflict. But I should say, we are focusing primarily on Jewish-Israeli audiences. We want to engage Jewish-Israeli audiences. And doing that, I think our experience is that working with Israeli officials, providing a version of history that is different than the one that the official story provides, is very helpful. At the same time, we try not to forget the fact that we have a duty to tell the story, also to also provide the perspective of the other side. Sometimes we can refer to as victims. I'm not a big fan of that particular term. But certainly Palestinians who were active, who were part of the particular cases that we speak of. It is not always easy. Israeli government archives often focus in their holdings on the work of the Israeli state. And many Palestinian sources are actually still closed in Israeli archives. It's a major issue for us, which we try to tackle all the time.
Why did you feel that focusing on the perspective of the official narrative will resonate more with Jewish Israeli audiences than testimonies from victims, so to speak?
I don't think it's focusing on the Israeli official narrative. It's focusing on Israeli sources. And the Israeli sources and the angle that they provide, or the facts that they document in various sources, very often are different than the Israeli official narrative, for this matter.
In what sense?
Think of any issue, really any issue that is relevant to you, to the conflict, and certainly to human rights in the conflict. The treatment of Bedouin in the Negev, and handling the where they are and where they are located to, and the reasons for building special townships for them. Think of house demolitions, which are often in over the past 20, 30 years have been sold to the courts and to the public as a means of deterrence. But when you go to the earlier roots of this policy, you see documents speaking of this policy as one of direct punishment. Policies on Jerusalem, the reasons behind drawing the map the way that it is, you know, again, in one of our earlier cases, we found documentation which showed that it was actually Israeli government top secret decision from 1968 that causes that in my kids' schools, the map of Israel is drawn without the green line on it. Basically everything that you can think of related to policies and practice in context of this conflict has it documented. Key issue for us is obviously is how to get access to this documentation. On this, I think we developed a bit of expertise on Israeli archives law, and we are in a working relationship with leadership of the main Israeli government archives, which allow us, in a very slow process, to have interesting files declassified for our purposes. Obviously, when they are declassified for us, they are also being declassified for the entire public.
So you're saying that you often find there's a difference between the official version of events and then what the documents prove about the reasoning of a certain decision.
I think so. I think an easy example, or a very clear example, is the state's sort of outlook on state's view on the applicability of the first Geneva Convention to the occupied territories, to the occupied Palestinian territories. This is a story that I'm sure is a bore to the vast majority of your audiences, but people involved in human rights work in the West Bank, for us, this is a key question. The state's position for many, many years since the early 1970s is that the Fourth Geneva Convention, which sets the guidelines for what an occupying force can and cannot do in an occupied territories, the state says it is willing to sort of voluntarily act in line with the convention, although it is not applicable to the West Bank and Gaza Strip. If you dig, as we did, in various documents of 1967, you actually realize that the point of view of the key legal minds of the time was that there is no question that the Fourth Geneva Convention is applicable to the occupied territories. But it raised a number of problems for the state on dealing with the population, on Jerusalem and its legal status, etc., etc. So we find a document in which then military advocate general Meir Shamgar briefs members of the Foreign Affairs and Security Select Committee describing the fact that the Fourth Geneva Convention applies. This is after the occupation, right? But then we see how later on Shamgar himself develops a line that is the same as the one we have till today, that the Fourth Geneva Convention is actually not applicable, that we are voluntarily applying its what they call humanitarian principles as if there are any other principle in that particular convention. So this and various other related documents, like on deportation.
I think settlement. I think in the early years, the Israeli sold to the world that the settlement are part of effort to the name is Itayeshvut Bitchonit, security settlement, and it sounds good. If you need to settle because you need to protect yourself, okay? But when you read the document, you see that the true story is not security, but it's the alliance between the Gush Emunim or the right wing in the government and the IDF, for example. So it gives you a different. It's not a different point of view. This is the true story of the settlement. Okay, it's a matter of greater Israel. It's not a matter of protecting Israel. Okay, so this is what document give you. Now, if you are telling this story, this narrative, if you like, without document, it's weaker. But if you have the document, like we find some document of Shlomo Gazit.
He was Moshe Dayan's Minister of Defense aide on the occupation.
Yeah, something like this. And we find a few documents that he wrote that there is no, in 68, 69, like it's the early years of the occupation, that there is no connection between security and settlement. This settlement or other settlement are part of our effort for greater Israel. Okay.
I do want to go back to the question of sources, because there is a clear imbalance between the weight given to documents written by Israeli scholars or discoveries made by Israeli scholars versus testimonies and research done by Palestinians. My colleague Amjad Iraqi wrote a piece on 972 titled "Don't Wait for Israeli Archives to Prove What Palestinians Already Know." How, to what extent do you integrate Palestinian sources in your research, and how do you reconcile Akivot's work with the fact that Palestinian testimonies don't usually carry the same kind of weight in exposing the reality in Israel-Palestine?
I think I should stress that Akivot in our work is not academic. We are using the sources that are available to us. We are trying to tell as accurate story as we can based on these sources. And as I said, we are doing a very active effort to incorporate the Palestinian perspective into them. However, we have made a conscious decision to base our work mostly on archival research. And in that, we are consigned to what archives actually hold, or what they allow to the public to access. Akevot is not the only one doing research on the Israel-Palestinian conflict, and various actors have the various means to tell their stories, and this is great. From our point of view, we try to use the available sources, as I said, which often are coming from the perspective of state officials, but also the same sources also hold at least partial testimony to Palestinians' versions, to Palestinians' complaints, to Palestinians' letters, to Palestinian testimonies in various places. This is all part of the story we are researching. We don't see our role as collecting oral history from people, even though we're just about to do just that in one of the projects we are commencing.
Well, you mentioned before that some of the archives that Israel is holding are actually Palestinian archives that they looted.
Yeah,
do you have access to those files?
Palestinian archives have been taken and transferred to Israeli custody since 1948 on. In every war, we have documents from the Israeli State Archive in 1967, where the chief archivist of the time is setting procedures to take archives from the occupied territories, etc. Some of these are actually open to the public. Some collections are open, many others are not. Often these collections actually tell, when we talk of the archives of that were taken in 1967, these are archives of mostly the Jordanian rule in the West Bank or the Egyptian rule in Gaza Strip. Our focus is Israel and the acts of the Israeli government and Israeli state policy. We are Israelis. We are working in context of our society. To be honest, this is our main concern. So in this regard, this, to me personally, there's not a lot of interest to what Jordan did in Hebron in 1962, for this matter. Other researchers would have different interests. That's fine. That's part of the landscape. We are a human rights organization. We are a human rights research center. And as always, I think, very often, certainly in the context of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, our concern is what our state is doing. Our concern is holding our state and society accountable for the role they play in this conflict, for the role various mechanisms and events play in prolonging this conflict, etc. So in this regard, somebody just emailed us, what was it, 2 days ago, asking us, telling us, hey, your research is great, but do you also work the archives of the PLO and Jordan and Egypt, etc.? Which is a legitimate question, but it's a legitimate question, but for us, for our work, most important archives are Israeli archives, or where Israeli archives stay silent. We go to other international archives, like the ICRC archive in Geneva, where we worked quite a bit on uncovering specific cases that the Israeli IDF archive refused to declassify documentation on.
Adam, you mentioned that for the book on the military rule, you had to work, you had to go through 6 or 7 archives. What archives does Akevot actually work with? What are these archives, if you could name them and explain what they are?
I think the main archives, first of all, is the state archives, okay, which is one of the biggest archives in Israel. This is the formal archive of the state, and the IDF archives. I think for this book, these two archives were the major archive that we collect documents from them. But because it's very difficult to tell the story, the whole story, based on this archive, because as Lior mentioned earlier, most of the documentation are closed. So we work in other archives, like the archives of political party, and so on. So you start from the basic or the main archives, and then you try to figure out what you can find there, what is open, what is closed, and what kind of angle you have. And then you go to other archives and to collect the document there. And there sometimes documents that you can't find in the IDF archives, you will find in
a small municipal archive somewhere.
The process of gathering the documents it's take time.
Do you have to deal at all with any private archives?
We were able to get copies of collections that various people have collected themselves over the years, be them historians who were kind enough to provide us copies of their collections, as well as Adam's very skilled with talking with family members and dig up old boxes from attics.
I think one of the most interesting material we got in recent years was, and I used them to write my book about the Kfar Kassem massacre. Was
this was in 1956?
56, yes. A big part of the book are based on documents that I got from a family. Okay, and it's not a box or a few files. We are talking about thousands of pages.
The family of victim, or
no?
The family of one soldier
who participated in the massacre, and so it takes time. It's a unique dynamic that you need to evolve, to adapt in this kind of situation. But we also, well, it was much, much better if you can go to the IDF archive and ask for the document. But because I can't do it, we need to find a different and a different way.
You mentioned that one of the things you focus on is advocating for better access to the archives. What challenges do you meet in your work in trying to look for documents and access documents?
I think for us, as well as any other researcher who needs to base their work on Israeli government archives, first of all, it's difficult to know what the archive actually holds. Israeli state archives only allow on their website access to some 50-something percent of the titles in their catalog. For the IDF archive, this figure is even much lower. So first of all, you don't know what the archive actually holds. You don't know what you don't know, in practical terms. And then you have various means in which requests to declassify files are either rejected without any proper reasoning, or they're not rejected, but the process of declassifying these files can take anything between a month and 3 years. We've had various cases on both of these ends, which is also partly the reason why not many people, researchers or others, rely on Israeli government archives for their kind of research, which in turn again serves this impact of having a very little fact-based history of our recent history.
What do you hope to achieve with the work that you do?
What we are trying to do is, first of all, be able to serve as a hub for research, for storytelling, and for perhaps better understanding of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, based on this archival documentation that we hold and the one that we continue to search for. And this can serve any number of purposes, both in terms of the all-important task of supporting human rights campaigns, human rights work today, as well as supporting the work of journalists, documentary filmmakers, and various other actors who have a role in mediating to audiences what actually happened here over the past 70-something years. I think this too is a combination of our major task, which we'll probably go on doing in the foreseeable future.
Lior, Adam, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you very much, Ingrid.
This episode was produced by the editors of 972 Magazine. If you don't want to miss any new episodes, go to www.972mag.com.
So that's it for us for today. You are listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CQUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Until next time, I wish you a free, free Palestine.
It takes a good dose of courage and perseverance to get through a pandemic.
True, but it also takes a good dose of patience, resilience, confidence, optimism, humor, and love. Not to mention a dose of determination, endurance, empathy, motivation, hope, and ingenuity.
But above all, it takes a second dose of vaccine.
A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
Love itself represents an impossibility.